to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
How do we choose where to put playgrounds? Well, playgrounds are actually a pretty big indicator of service levels in general across the city.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, Lane County, and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's June 11th, 2021 program. Why playgrounds are worth the price. This is a 36th program for our 2020-21 programming year. My name is Kitty Piercy, and I'm the City Club president. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Our programs are always available on YouTube channel and on our Facebook page and are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 on Mondays at 7. In today's program, we welcome Emily Proudfoot, Principal Landscape Architect of the City of Eugene. I got to know Emily when I was mayor of Eugene, so I'm really looking forward to this presentation. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. I would like to thank Mary Layton for coordinating today's program. In 2018, Eugene voters approved a bond measure that would produce more than $39 million for parks, recreation centers, and playgrounds. By the end of this year, about a dozen projects will be complete. Earlier, the city spent more than $1.1 million on renovations at Amazon Playground. Many remember playgrounds of yore, where kids, glad to find a metal slide, a set of big swings, and a merry-go-round with a puddle filling the rut around it. What have we learned that makes us willing to invest so much now in child's play? The City of Eugene's Emily Proudfoot will explain and discuss.
Thanks, Kitty. Hi, this is Mary Layton. I'm a member of the program committee, but more relevant to this program, I'm a grandma. And like most of the grandmas in town who have grandchildren available, I've gotten more familiar with parks this year than I might otherwise have been. The other day when I was at Amazon Park, I was noticing how the kids were interacting with the equipment. And on one really nice day, I noticed that many of the grown-ups were lying on the turf and the children were carefully stepping over them because it was such nice turf. And I began to wonder, how did this park come to be this way? It works so well for the children it serves. Who thinks up this stuff? So for some reason, I had the address of a person in the city who might know, and I sent that person the question, who's in charge of parks? Who makes the playgrounds so nice? And that person said, Emily Proudfoot. So I asked Emily Proudfoot if she would talk to us about how she makes decisions about playgrounds. What are the variables that are involved? How does she, you know, why do they cost so much? Which is part of why they look the way they look. So I asked Emily to start in honor of graduation week to talk a little bit about her career path, perhaps to inspire some of this year's graduates to think about being a playground designer. And then Emily will explain to us how parks and playgrounds are designed and why they cost so much. Emily.
Well, thank you, Mary, and good afternoon, City Club, and thanks for having me today. So to answer Mary's first question, how did I become a playground designer? Well, I have a bachelor's degree in landscape architecture from the University of Oregon. And with that degree, you can do many things. And so over the years, I've worked in private practice. And then starting in 1999, I began my work with the City of Eugene as a landscape architect and project manager for parks and open space. At the time, I was in charge of implementing park projects for the 1998 bond measure that had passed at the time. And then for the last 22 years, I've been involved in designing and implementing and planning for parks and playgrounds across the community. Most of my work has been in developed parks. And so you'll hear more between the distinction between developed parks and natural areas. But my work overall has been really kind of developed through experience and really what's been fun for my own children. And then being inspired by playgrounds across the world that, you know, we look at with our colleagues in municipal governments or local design offices throughout the country. So that has what is brought me here today. And so it is a topic. Playgrounds are a topic that are near and dear to my heart. And so I'm really happy to be able to share the city's work in this realm. I'll be presenting some basics about how we plan for playgrounds across the city, and then why they're an important component of our developed park system. So I'll start by talking about planning for playgrounds citywide. And so the questions about why do we even build playgrounds, which is I'll share some information about child development, and then just basics about playground design and how we've innovated over time. Project costs, or what I prefer to think of as investments, and then where we're headed in the future of playground design within Eugene's parks and open space system. So to begin with, we have over 5,000 total acres in parks ownership in our City of Eugene park system. More than 4,000 acres of our system is within natural areas, which I always like to think of as a solid balance for a community that values conservation so highly. In addition, we have 600 acres of developed parks. So those are parks that include benches and playgrounds and sort of typical park amenities. And then we have 325 acres of future developed parks. So parks, land that we own, but that have not been yet developed as developed parks. So how do we choose where to put playgrounds? Well, playgrounds are actually a pretty big indicator of service levels in general across the city. So in these two maps, you can see on the left, park and playground service areas. We did some gap analysis as part of our system planning in 2015 and 16. On this map, there are orange areas and red areas that are areas shown on this map as relatively unserved by park playgrounds. And so we do include school playgrounds as part of that service. And so the school district does give us a big boost in playground service by keeping their playgrounds open to the general public when school is not in session. And then on the right, we have existing and proposed playgrounds. And so probably about 20 of them where we're proposing new playgrounds across the community. Now, this is basically geographic equity. And so are we distributing them evenly across the community? We all know that kids love playgrounds and they're popular in Eugene, but what are other good reasons for playground construction? Well, from a child development standpoint, and this is a very sort of basic starter, but public playgrounds serve an important role in providing a place where children develop critical human functions. So tactile learning is obviously learning through touch. One of the things that we put in, these are all photos of the Amazon Park playground. And actually one of the things that many people have exclaimed to us is that a lot of people love the touch and feel of the turf there. But learning to grip things or climb things or play music, that tactile learning is very important for children. Your vestibular system is one that where you learn, that develops and figure out balance and your general equilibrium, and then coordinating your head and your eyes. And so, you know, spinning and swinging and those kinds of bodily movements are very important to developing the vestibular system. And kids do that all the time. They'll just hang from a little bar and swing because it's something that their body is, you know, telling to do as part of that developmental process. And then proprioception is the development of muscles and movement and awareness of your body position. So of course, again, you know, spinning, swinging, climbing, sliding, those kinds of things, and climbing in particular, really help build that proprioceptive system in your body. And then certainly last, but definitely not least, social interaction, you know, within a playground setting is really critical for all people, regardless of your age or ability. And so playing imaginative games, cooperating, making space for each other, chasing, just playing in general are very important to developing social interactions. And then secondly, there are volumes of critical research and writing on the importance of children experiencing the outdoors. And I, you know, as we come out of the COVID pandemic, I think that we probably couldn't be more aware of how important the outdoors has been for all of us in maintaining our mental health through a really, really difficult time. And of course, children are definitely included in that mix. But again, much of this research shows that being outside is really important for stress reduction. It's important for discovery. So, you know, what can you find out there that you couldn't find out by just being inside? So discovery about your bodies, discovery about nature, all kinds of things. It develops communication and problem solving, so cooperation with other people, challenges and success. So really being able to accomplish something in the outdoors. The outdoors provides all kinds of opportunities for that. It promotes healthy bodies, creates childhood memories, and even builds communities. So a lot of times we come together around playgrounds and we go for a hike all together. You meet a parent you haven't met before, or a grandparent, or, you know, you talk about how your children are developing together. Whatever it is, parks and playgrounds play a huge role in building community. And as social beings, and as we've found out again in COVID, that social interaction is really critical to keep staying positive within our mental health realm. Let's talk a little bit about design. So as a professional, I have a list of criteria that I think about when I'm designing or reviewing the design of a playground. And since I've done a lot of playgrounds, you know, even though I sort of at a little bit more of a management level these days, I'm still pretty involved in even things like making sure that there's enough diversity of components, that the layout looks good, and I even pick colors. So from my perspective, these are the goals we should try to accomplish when we're designing a playground. So a playground should engage kids to use all different parts of their body. So if you only have steps and slides, well, you don't, you know, you're not doing any overhead activities or climbing or some things like that. So I like to see a diversity of activities. It should include items that foster pretend play. So is there a tiny little shop counter? Or are there some little benches in a little circle? Or are there, you know, is there a sand play table where you add water and make cakes? Ideally, the equipment shouldn't tell you how to play with it. So I think it may not be intuitive how to interact with a piece, and that's all the better often for children, just in kind of figuring out some kinesthetic things about their body. So a slide is fairly obvious. You climb the stairs and you slide down, and that, you know, that's a classic piece. But maybe there's an awkward ladder that you don't know how to climb, or there's some ropes and some funny bubbles, and how do you interact with that? And so I think that just engages a different part of your brain as a child, and that's really valuable. It creates the opportunity for creative problem solving. Include the classics if you have room. So classics, of course, swings, slides, and merry-go-rounds are always very popular. And in playground design, we definitely have to keep space between pieces of equipment. So if you have room for swings, it's great to put them in. Everybody loves a swing. And then my last bullet here is design for inclusion as much as possible. So inclusion really means that we're creating a space where as many people of different ages and abilities can play within the same realm. A lot of that has to do with firm surfacing, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But again, really providing a space where everyone can be included is a very valuable component of a playground. How do we know if we're going to build a big playground or a small playground? So basically, we're building playgrounds in two different types of parks, our community and metropolitan park playgrounds. So maybe think of Skinner Butte or Amazon Park, Westmoreland Park or Bethel Park. Those are community metropolitan parks. And in those spaces, we can build a much bigger playground because we are serving a much broader area. So generally, we have a 2-mile service area. And then a lot of times, these playgrounds are also destinations. So we definitely include more amenities for different age groups. We usually have spray play, maybe there's a skate park nearby, sand and water, a restroom, and definitely as we're developing new playing grounds, fully inclusive surfacing. So that turf surfacing that you see that we have at Amazon is definitely our way forward in community parks. Neighborhood park playgrounds are definitely smaller. They're within neighborhood scale parks. They're within a 1/2 mile walking service area. So, and that's a safe walking. So you don't cross a major arterial, like let's say West 18th Avenue, unless there's a specific pedestrian crossing that you can cross. They usually have fewer elements while maintaining a variety of activities. And then usually they don't have spray play. Sometimes there's sand and water, but we usually try to have a some sort of structure that incorporates lots of things, maybe a few individual elements and ideally a sand play area. So that's the difference between big and small playgrounds and where we put them. Basically, I've been designing playgrounds for 20 years, and around 1998, 1999, when I came on board, both the Consumer Product Safety Commission, I believe that's it, the CPSC and the ASTM, the American Society for Testing and Materials, came up with a set of safety rules by which play structures would be designed, playgrounds would be designed. And really, this was intended to start to address a series of, you know, sort of consistent playground injuries that children were experiencing within parks. And so they're very thorough. And what it resulted in was kind of a lot of very boring playground structures. So you would see a lot of platforms which you would climb up, you would slide down, and maybe there's a tube to crawl through. But in general, there wasn't a lot of sort of dynamic things going on with playgrounds. And so within that realm, as landscape architects and parks planners, we did a lot of work at the City of Eugene to innovate to the degree that we could possible, you know, that we could within this set of safety regulations. So playground and play structure design is largely driven by play equipment manufacturers. And so the onus of meeting those safety regulations largely falls on them. So it was really, I felt like incumbent on us to integrate more fun and more artistry into our public playgrounds. And so art has been kind of a big piece of this effort, and places where we've incorporated artwork, like there's some climbing columns at the Skinner Butte River Play project. Those are made out of concrete and made to look like basalt rock on a sort of a smaller scale. Those were done by an artist. There's inlaid artwork in many of our playgrounds. At Oakmont Park, there's a wonderful set of little animals set into our splayper area. And then back again at the River Play Playground, we have bronze art underneath the sand play area there as sort of a archaeological excavation area. And then we've done a lot of tile work also as sort of sponsorship items. So it's brought a lot of creativity and color into some of these playground areas. And then, you know, we've learned a ton. So we've had a lot of successes in some of our creative designs, and then definitely some lessons learned, which typically means we've discovered design flaws that come up within long-term maintenance discussions. So we've chronically been challenged, of course, with our operational funding for parks. And so that, you know, really it's become ever more apparent and incumbent that we design for ease of maintenance over the long run while providing a high level of fun in our parks. So, you know, water and sand are things that kids want to put together almost like it's almost biological. They must go together. So a lot of times if there's a drinking fountain too close to a sand area, the drinking fountain is usually clogged because they've been mixing sand and water in the drinking fountain. How do we keep sand and plate chips separate from each other? And then how do we keep sand from poured in place surfacing because it sort of reduces its springiness. And, you know, so lots of design questions like that where we're, you know, learning to create separated areas, where we're learning to figure out how to minimize these maintenance challenges while still having it be really fun for children. With the 2018 bond measure, you know, we're 20 years later now, and there's been tons of innovation in the industry. So we have a lot less post-in platforms. There are a lot more climbing nets and twisty climbers and weird things that are sort of unfamiliar to children, which is great because they can go in and sort of figure out how to climb around. And it's really refreshing. And so with the 2018 bond measure, we'll be renovating and constructing new playgrounds across the city. And we're looking forward to just building in a lot more fun for everyone with some of this new and creative equipment. So, and again, still keeping some of the classics. So making sure there's swings and slides and some of those items that we all had fun with as children. Now to the question of the session, which is, why are playgrounds so costly? And I actually prefer to think again of construction expenses as investments in our community, investments in the development of our children, and then investment, you know, just on the ground in assuring long-term safety for users of our play equipment. So, you know, we invest in very durable materials and equipment so that we have them for a long time and that they are easily maintainable for the long term. So we're not coming back, you know, we really look at a 20 to 25 year lifespan for a playground, if at all possible. And from a long-term maintenance perspective, we really take the tack that investing more now means we can operate it with less expenses down the road. So there's a lot of design time that goes into these playgrounds. There's a lot of investment in the subgrade. So underneath the ground, how are the playgrounds drained? And it's everything. So I'm sure many of you have experienced the, you know, overly large puddles around merry-go-rounds and places like that, or at the end of slides or under swings. And providing appropriate subgrade drainage is critical to maintaining a functional playground. And then the safety surfacing is also very important. So we have to have surfacing that allows for impact attenuation so that children are safe, not if they fall, but when they fall off equipment. You know, there's plenty of guardrails and all kinds of other things, but, you know, children are really exploring their abilities, and sometimes that leads to a fall, and they need to be able to fall safely. And then throughout both installation and then into long-term maintenance, we have inspections and audits. What we're really looking for is look to pass a set of tests that's prescribed by both the CPSC and the ASTM guidelines, and so that we don't have tiny places for kids to pinch their fingers, or and that the connections are tight, or that you can't get caught on a piece of clothing, and then that we're appropriately spaced apart, and all kinds of details. So that's a big piece of installing playground equipment. And again, it's an investment in safety of children, and then an investment in kids really developing within our community in a way that's really fun and positive. So what does playground design look like maybe for the next 20 years? So there's definitely playground trends, and we'll look to embrace them as best we can system-wide. But we'll, you know, first and foremost, we'll continue to assure that we're meeting ADA in our playground designs. And so providing equal opportunities for play for all children, regardless of abilities. We'll do that better for children who use walkers and wheelchairs at playgrounds where we can have more firm surfacing that doesn't displace as easily. But many of the specialty chips that we use do technically meet the letter of the ADA. But it also is about providing equal opportunities for ground level experiences as well as elevated. And then there's lots of talk about nature play. What about nature play? And nature play is really popular. And I think in Portland, we've seen some remarkable nature playgrounds that are just so much fun. And, you know, they're harder to maintain over time because there's a lot of natural materials, and so they need replacement or, you know, replenishment on a daily basis, or, you know, depending upon what the activity is for the playground. You know, we know that they have a lot of play value, and there's also some pretty good anecdotal data that parents are more likely to jump in and play with their kids in natural area playgrounds. So I think that's pretty awesome. And we'll definitely be looking to implement more of these types across our system over time. And then what about inclusive play? So inclusive play is, again, it goes beyond the ADA. So it really talks more about providing the ability for all children of all abilities and all people to be able to access play components or access structures and have the social interaction that is so important to all kids, you know, between each other. So, you know, at every community park, again, we'll, you know, invest in that surfacing, but I think there's also some really great creative design opportunities with materials and products that we'll be seeing as time goes on. We've certainly seen the industry really promote inclusive playgrounds and come up with wonderful designs for that. And it's meeting a wonderful need. I think the renovation of Amazon Park was really focused on inclusivity, as Amazon had a history of having the first ADA accessible play structure. And so we replaced that play structure with the new one and then provided much more accessibility around the playground as a whole. And then just now, over the last year, with what we've learned, you know, from social justice issues and all kinds of equity issues, we're starting to look beyond geography around playground equity. So the geographic perspective is we have a playground within a service area for everyone within a half mile safe walking distance of their house. But then I think the next questions that we're looking to answer are we appropriately serving surrounding neighborhoods? So, you know, instead of just looking at location and, you know, sort of general state of the equipment, how old it is, when it was built, is it fun? I think we're starting to look at, oh, what is the level of density of housing around this park playground? And what does that mean for what we should be putting in for play equipment? Is there a strong culture within the neighborhood that we should be thinking about? What about history? What about safety? And, you know, much more. So we're developing those additional criteria, I think, to attempt to be responsive to this sort of, you know, almost, I guess, fourth dimension of considerations around how we evaluate playgrounds and how we would renovate them or improve them to be responsive to adjacent neighborhood needs.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our Facebook page for more topics. We hope you are inspired to join us for our next podcast episode.